sitting in a noisy lobby at the Crowne Plaza in Kitchener with Harry Manx. How are you doing, Harry?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me on your show today, Marco.
In this format, I've been talking to different musicians about their lives and how they got to where they are today. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty well what I want to kind of do with you. You were born in Isle of Man.
That's right.
Did you live there much?
I lived there till I was five, and it took me till I was 59 to get back there. I left at five, and I came back at 59.
So at five, did you remember much? Was there any impression that...
Not really, you know. The Isle of Man is a very small place, and one thing everyone knows about is the motorcycle races. They used to zoom by my house once a year. I remember that part for sure.
And then you moved to Canada.
Yeah, we moved to Markham when it was just a little village of 3,000 people.
Okay, and then what I know is that music came into your life, but I don't know how it came into your life. How did music...
Well, you know, I was pretty much from a kind of a broken home, if you will, and when I was 15, I was looking for somewhere to live, and I heard there was a band living on the outskirts of town called Tribe. And I went out there, knocked on the door, and said, you know, I'm looking for a place to live. Do you need a roadie or something? And they said, most certainly. And they invited me in.
But did you know anything about being a roadie?
No. I had some gumption, so that was all that was needed, apparently. And they invited me in, and I lived with them. And it turned out there were some great musicians in that band, like amazing musicians. Jerry Doucette was the guitar player.
Oh, okay.
And he taught me to play. He was my first teacher.
Okay, so you didn't play at that
point? No, I didn't play anything. I was just a kid hanging around. And he taught me to play. Ronnie Headland, a guy that became well-known in Toronto in the 70s, had a tragic end, a great musician. He was in that band. Nate Jones, ex-drummer James Brown, was in that band.
Wow.
So we lived in this country farmhouse, and, you know, they practiced all day, and then I started to practice, too, all day, and I started to learn to play from those guys.
Okay, so at that point, what would you have been playing?
I played the bass. I started with the bass guitar.
And so musically, what would you... What
would we played blues.
Okay.
You know, you got to play blues. That's all that was on all our records were blues. And they weren't really a blues band, but everything they did was informed by their connection with the blues. They played a lot of rock.
And so are we talking Muddy Waters?
Yeah, Chicago blues, most definitely. More than anything else, Chicago blues. And it's good to remember, like in that time, we all know that in the 60s and part of the 70s too, most of the live music was blues, and there was blues everywhere, you know. And look, the Rolling Stones were a blues band. So blues was what everybody did who was a rock musician at that time.
Right.
That's what I got into.
And at this point, you're still a roadie. That's what you're thinking. You're not thinking I'm going to be a musician.
No. I was just a roadie. I was enjoying it. But, you know, after a couple of years, I left. And by the time I was 17, I got a gig with the great band Crowbar. Hmm. I was driving their bus and setting up the stage. So I was on the roadie track, you know, and I started touring the country with those guys. And then I think the last gig I had was I went out across Canada with Rush doing stage monitors. And wow. I must have been about 18, coming up 19 by then. But by then I was getting cured of the rock and roll business and being a roadie. And I was thinking, I got to do something with music that's not so loud. I love the sound of James Taylor. I love the sound of acoustic guitars. And I also love blues, but there's other sounds which I love. So I did quit that, and I decided that I'd move to Europe and declare myself a musician on the streets of Paris.
Okay, so before that, did I read correctly that you were the sound guy at the Elmo Combo?
At the Elmo Combo, yeah. I did about 6 months at the Elmo upstairs, and it was a great gig. I saw such great acts there. You know, just one night I looked beside me and Joni Mitchell was sitting beside me by the sound desk.
Right.
Things like that. No, every night it was a great act. I think I got a great education in the world of blues watching those guys play. I didn't learn any licks from them. What I learned was the feel of the groove, how deep it was, how difficult but seemingly easy. You know.
But at this point, you're still not playing in front of people.
I'm not playing much. No, I'm playing a little bit, but not much, you know. I put my energy into my being a roadie and, you know, and partying, chasing girls, drinking a lot. That was where I put my focus.
Well, as long as you were
I'm
focused.
I'm a teenager, right?
But now you're thinking, okay, I'm going to go to Europe and become a musician.
Yeah, that's what I did. I landed in London first, and I was there for a while. And then I went over to Paris. My brother was a busker in Paris. So I got my guitar, and I started busking, too. And, you know, I started playing blues. That's all I knew how to play, basically. Eventually, I started playing more stuff. Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Bob Marley, all that stuff. You know, whatever people wanted to hear. And my street musician life went on for quite a long time in Europe.
I know we've talked about this before. I remember you talking about
deep.
Some buskers made a lot of money and made a good living doing
it. Oh,
that.
Yeah. You know, there was good days and bad days, but if you knew where and when, you could make... I remember living in Switzerland and playing on the street and realizing one day that my income was the same as the bank manager at my bank down the road, because his wife was a friend and she told me how much he makes. And I realized, well, that's great, because I'm working on the street playing music and making the same cash. So it could be a lucrative gig, you know. It's not always easy.
I can imagine.
Tough
so
grind.
Tell me, you know, I remember interviewing Chris Whitley about his time.
Yeah.
And he was talking about busking. And for him, he thought it was a lot easier because he didn't have to, they could just stand there and play, do whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that he had to put himself out there. But how did you approach being a busker?
Yeah, you know, you have a great freedom. You have you can do what you like. But whether that pays off at the end of the day or not, that's you know, to be seen. You start catering to what people like at some point if you want to sort of increase your response from the people, you know. But until then, you can just blast out whatever you feel, and that's what I did too. I remember Chris, when I was living in Europe, he was living in Ghent in Belgium.
Okay. Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
I used to see him playing in
oh,
Ghent.
Really?
Oh, by then he was playing in the little cafe bar, and it was like packed to the roof, hot and sweaty, and he was just wailing, and it was all wow, really, really rich.
Yeah, he was really a special
good
person.
Yeah, he was right out there and giving it all. And I traveled up and down Europe playing streets, but eventually started to get a few gigs, and that changed the course of things. You know, I get a few club gigs and a few festival gigs, and slowly, I got some confidence as a musician.
But is it, okay, so I would presume busking is a great way to just practice and hone in on your craft, but financially, is the type of thing you just busk so that you're making money for the day and or the couple of days, and that's
depends on your act, you know. Some guys don't make much, and some guys make a bomb. It really depends on your act. So if you figured out where and when, you can make a lot of money.
But you're thinking, this is my way into getting into clubs and doing bigger and better.
You know, I never thought of that. I never thought of, like, I'm on my way to getting professional. I thought the street was a way of life, and I looked at it like that. And when I moved over to Japan, that was it, you know. I never considered that I would work in a club. I mean, if I went to a club, for instance, you know, maybe they'd give me $100 for playing there, but I know on the street that day I might make $500 or $600 because I could sell my discs and I would, you know, pass the hat and I could encourage people to pay. So it was actually more profitable to be on the street.
And then in Japan, was language an issue or?
No. It's, you know, it's a real asset being an Englishman singing English songs. It's a real plus there.
So, but one day you just said, I'm going to go to Japan and do this.
Well, I met a Japanese woman and sort of fell in love. And the next thing I know, we were off to Japan living in Tokyo. So there it was.
Wait a second, musician, woman? What is this?
You follow where the breeze is blowing, don't you?
And then you went to India.
Yeah, then I went to India. What, you know, India, this is sort of a parallel story. Because I went to India the first time in 79. And I was 24 at the time, and I stayed for a year. I had no money. I spent the last money I had on a sitar, and I just wandered around and got the feel of the place and suffered a fair bit, you know, because I had no money and no wherewithal. But I had a wonderful experience, and it was very rich. I decided I would come back there again and stay a longer time, which is what I did in 86.
So when you say suffered a bit, tell me about the lesson you learned from that experience, not necessarily just the suffering, but obviously it wasn't easy to be there with no money, but
yeah.
You know, it was enough for you to say, I'm going to come back here. Tell me what impression
you
made.
Oh yeah, you know, like I was interested in that part of India, the meditation, the spiritual aspect of India. That's what really drove me there. And that becomes richer and richer as you stay there. You start to dig in deeper to it, and you start to find out a few teachers who are around, and you go and visit them, and you hang with them. And that was really my path, and I wanted to come back and do that. The music was turning me on Indian music, but I had no idea how I would get into it. It wasn't until the second time I was living there that I dug into the music. But you know, the suffering part, I have to say, was probably like self-inflicted by and large, you know, because right. I knew I was going there with no money. I didn't care. I wanted my freedom, and I wanted to do what I wanted to do without waiting for money to have its way with me. So I went there in that sort of self-imposed suffering, and in a way it was great. It was a lot of unlearning in that, you know. I unlearned all the ideas I had about living through that experience, and that suffering somehow informed my art eventually. I can see that now.
And musically, what was it that drew you into the Indian music?
Well, the depth of Indian music is unbelievable. Like, it's kind of like blues. You hear a huge history in it. You hear some deep things that you can't put your finger on. Indian music is like that. It turns you in. It's almost scary. What you feel, the vastness of your interior world, that's a sound. The Indian music drives me towards that, you know, and I found myself overwhelmed by that music, but still not thinking that I could play it, but just really impressed by it.
And so you made the connection with your mentor.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name now.
Vishwa Mohan Bhatt.
So how open was he to bringing you in and
Oh, yeah, you know, if you're after a master, you don't care if he's open or not. You're going to force him into it. You know, you can't be a wimp in these situations. And that's part of their, you know, thousand-year-old tradition. Like, Ravi Shankar had to wait at the gates outside of his master's place. His master was a court musician. They were still court musicians up until the 50s, the 40s. In India, there was no public musicians. So he waited outside of the gate until his master came every day, and he waved at him, and he tried to get his attention. And finally, one day, he stopped and talked to him, and then he invited him in to play. And for me, Vishwa Mohan Bhatt, you know, I knew he was a great player, but these guys don't make it easy to become their disciple, you know. They put you off so that it's sort of like a test to see if you got the, what it takes, you know, to study. I showed up there at 3 in the morning, and I could have waited the next day to knock on his door, but I didn't. I woke him up. You know, I think that
impression.
Sort of said something right there. You know, I was that, and I sat down like I was ready to stay. He looked at me and said, okay, come tomorrow morning, you know.
Oh, okay. So
came,
he didn't.
And by the end of the day, he'd already given me an instrument. He realized that I wasn't going away. I saw the beauty that was his playing, and I was ready to be there, and I think he understood that.
Okay, so is this in character? Like, have you ever done anything else like this before?
Yeah, you know, I pretty much go for what I see, you know, and try to make it work. Yeah, that's in character for me. but I understood that about the master-disciple relationship in India, that it's not easy, and that you need to demonstrate that you're going to be there, because money isn't going to do it. He's not going to teach you for money.
Right.
In fact, he won't take any money if you try to give it to him, but he'll accept you if you're that dedicated. And I would come and I'd touch his feet and I'd prostrate myself as every other disciple would, and say, "Yeah, man, I'm here. Teach me something."
Okay, the fact that you were not Indian, did that make, or that you were a foreigner, did that make any advantage or disadvantage to the situation?
Well, you know, I think that. They're very proud to have a Western disciple, you know, Indian musicians, because I think that it sort of qualifies what they're doing, in the eyes of other Indians.
Now, you spent 5 years with them. At what point did you think, I'm getting this, I understand this?
I haven't got there yet, but
but you had to. I read somewhere you had to unlearn some of the things that you like the way you played slide guitar.
How to hold the slide, where the note is, for instance. Like, I would play a note, he'd say flat. I'd play it again, sharp, flat, sharp. He'd go on all like this. Till, you know, after some months of practicing, I'd play and he goes, good. And I'd play again, good. So it's a case of, you know, someone who knows how to play really well, if you hang near them, you start playing better. You know, there's a kind of quantum leap of talent there. And I always played better around Vishwa. And he inspired me to practice, you know. I practice 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day. Just, you know, as a Westerner, it's not in my bones to play that music. So I had to give extra effort, listen extra hard to the sounds, and try to imagine the feeling that's in there, you know.
So when did the idea of using that music and making it your own and incorporating with the blues come into your head?
Yeah, you know, I loved the blues, and I played the blues, and I played Indian music, and I was studying with Vishwa, but at some point he went off to America, and he made a record with Rai Cooter. Mm-hmm. And didn't know he was going to do that. It happened on the spot, and he made that Meeting by the River record. And he came back, and he played it for me, and talked to me about it. And then I thought, well, you know, this is funny, because this is really what I do too, and this is funny that he has arrived at this place too, because prior to that, when I'd played some blues licks, they used to all laugh. So now I see that it had, you know, it really worked. It was a great combination.
So are you playing at all in public at this point?
No, I was a street musician still, and in Japan I would go back there and work, you know. I was sort of back and forth. Yeah, but I wasn't playing this stuff on any Indian stuff. It took me really so long before I brought that out, because, you know, I remember my mother hearing me play once. I'd been playing a few years, and I came to visit her, and I played a little bit. She said, it's nice, but it's not music.
That's the kind of encouragement.
So, you know, I thought, yeah, this is going to be a bit of a leap trying to get anybody to like this. But, you know... I bent all the rules eventually.
Right.
I played the ragas a little bit inside out, and I played the blues a little bit east, and I bent the rules until it suited my needs. I think that's sort of where I got to be creative in the whole process. First it was learning, but then come to my output, I needed to do something that was more original, and I tried to blend everything I knew in the music at that point.
So I met you 15 years ago, I think, and that was after... right around the time of your first album.
Yes.
So how do you look back on that first album and where you are musically at that point?
Well, it's funny. I don't know about other artists, but I'll go years without listening to my own music. And mm-hmm. I'll put my first album on. Sometimes I go, wow, it's pretty groovy. I like that. Yeah, I'm that far away from it now, you know. I remember for the first years after making it, though, I used to hear it. I'd cringe. I go, oh, I could do that better. I want to do that song again. You know, there's that self-criticism.
But in terms of what you were hoping to achieve musically, and maybe technically you might not have been there completely, but the idea of who Harry Manx is and the type of music that he plays, is that first album pretty well where you want it to be?
I guess so. You know, I didn't have a vision about where I was going or what my identity was, you know, musically. In fact, I was a little fearful putting out that first record that people would think, oh, it's kind of like... wishy-washy new age. Yeah, I didn't know, you know.
Right.
But I said this before, that the blues community in Canada was so welcoming to me. Mm-hmm. You know? And they looked at it like, oh, this is an addition. You're not taking anything away from the blues. You're adding something to it. So I took that really as an inspiration, and it spurred me on.
Like, you seem to gather following very quickly. Maybe... it might not seem that way to you, but you seem to have a following.
Oh,
and
yes,
just built
yes.
up very quickly.
Yeah, those people who were into it, they latched on to me pretty quick. And, you know, they're still there. I still get a good turnout for most of my shows.
And Australia was another one that was there from the very
beginning.
Yeah, right?
That was there also in the beginning. I sent somebody one CD down there, and he took it to somebody that took it to somebody at an agency. Eventually they heard it, and they called me and said, come down. And yeah, that's been going on 15 years.
It's a pretty impressive, and I don't know what it speaks to. Cause, you know, it's tough having a career and gaining a following.
Yes.
But from the very beginning, you seem to have that momentum, and every time I saw you, it seemed to get bigger and into different areas.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, and I know that if you say I'm going to play Quebec, or I'm going to play in certain areas, and you announce your dates, they seem to get sold out very quickly.
Yeah. It's working. I don't know, you know, what makes it all work. You sometimes wonder how long a shelf life you have as a musician. But I think it comes down to this, that as a musician, you need to keep growing. Mm-hmm. And once you're growing, you're not stagnant, you're not stuck. People haven't heard everything from you. They're still interested in you, so you can keep them engaged. To that end, I keep pouring out the records every year and try to change the act, try to, you know, better the act, improve it. And that's what keeps people interested in me.
Yeah, and you've done some really interesting things, like the things you've done with Kevin Bright, which
yeah.
is a neat pairing. And
Kev's a great guitar player, you know. My latest thing is working with a string section, string quartet.
Right.
And I'm rehearsing that now, writing the charts. And that'll come to Toronto in February 3rd at the Kerner Hall.
So this would be what kind of music?
Well, it'll be my songs, basically, and a few blues tunes, too, with string arrangements.
Wow.
Yeah, I want to bring that in. The strings are lush, you know, and they can really lift up certain harmonies and make powerful points in the song.
And is it a known string quartet? Or?
You know, it's all about the charts, the arrangements. You can get most string players to play them once you've got them. And in Toronto, I'll be playing with an all-female quartet, the Diva Quartet.
Okay.
And they're all young classical musicians, well-trained, unlike me.
Okay, so what is that like?
I actually got a musical education.
What is that like in terms of, you know, because I just had a conversation with somebody last night about the disciplines of the classical music and what they can do just by looking at sheet music versus people who can improvise, which a lot of them can't.
Yes, well, you know, I guess it's, I keep thinking that the reading of music and playing is a lot more left brain kind of activity, the same kind of brain that's good at organization and business and whatnot, you know. Intuition and creativity, I associate that with a more right brain activity. So, you know, you definitely see which part of themselves people are using to approach music. You know, the classical people, there, where they can grow is in the intuitive area, mm-hmm. you know. And for me, where I could grow would be in more knowledge of harmony. But I'm reluctant to take on any more knowledge because I've been doing it wrong for so long. I got it going on, you know. I don't want to mess with it.
But you have, from the very beginning, had this work ethic because you were out there constantly. I mean, there was, you know, if anybody was working hard, it was you, and you were covering territories all over the world.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of the home you saw, but for the longest time, I mean, you were out on the road like an insane amount of time. That discipline, where does that come from? Like, did you just know that this is, in order to survive in this game, this is what you had to do?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I always think of it like, you know, conquering the country one town at a time kind of thing, because I don't have radio hits, you know, but people get to know me through word of mouth, and then they start to come out. I kind of always had a pretty good work ethic because I don't work for anybody but me. And when you work for yourself, it's different, you know. You have a different amount of energy. You can be boundless, you know. I always feel like going out and doing stuff. And when I'm home, I'm not sitting around. Mostly I'm writing music or playing or creating something, you know. I like doing other things at home. I'm a sort of amateur carpenter, and I've rebuilt my house about 3 times.
Really? You yourself?
Yeah, and I got a van that I kind of decked out myself, a Sprinter van that's became my home on the road. So I do stuff like that. You know, creativity, when it's flowing, and, you know, it can be in doing the dishes, but it's the energy you bring, and I feel a fair bit of that.
So even when you were busking, did you feel that the sense of the work ethic? And
oh yeah, you got to get out there and play pretty much every day, you know. When I arrived in Canada in 2000 from India, you know, I already had it in my mind that I would play every day somewhere, and I didn't have any gigs, so I went to the street that day, and if I didn't want to go to the street, I'd go to an open mic, or I'd go try to get a gig from somebody. Or I played every day, and that was my approach to getting known, you know. I felt I had something to offer. And it was just a case of getting known.
You also had, at one point I spoke to you, and you said your goal was not to play in bars, but to play soft seat theaters.
Totally.
And that's, I don't know if it's been true since the very beginning, but you've managed to do that pretty consistently.
Yeah, yeah. I play a few bars. Bars can be good gigs too. But what I meant by that was like not to be a bar act.
You want it to be heard.
Yeah, not to be wallflower paper for anybody, you know. Like when you want people to really listen to everything you're doing, you know, and not every musician does because they don't have the details.
Right.
They have the broad strokes with their music. You know? But if you have the details and you want people to hear the details in a concert, the concert's the place you want to play. A silent audience is the audience you want. I can have some noise, but you know, the silence is also part of the music for me, so I don't like a lot of peripheral noise. I have challenges at festivals sometimes.
Yeah, but
that.
I wonder, I mean, I would think most musicians I talk to will feel the same way, that they'd rather play soft-seat theaters than bars, most can't. So, nothing against them, but it's a difficult thing to achieve, to get to a point where you can go to a soft-seat theater and sell out most of the seats and get that following.
Music has to be very engaging in a soft-seater. Meaning, it can't be boring. You can't drift away as the player. You have to be present. It has to be really holding the audience. And in between songs, you have to speak to them. You know, it's a show. It's you know, there's so many ways to present music, but that way, you're under a microscope. So not every musician wants that.
No, I wonder. I mean, I think of you as a very successful musician who's very business-minded, who's done a lot around the world. I wonder if you've ever made mistakes. If you've ever made a career choice that you thought, that wasn't a good one.
Well, you know, early on in my career here in Canada, quite a few people told me, you know, you have to be careful here in Canada. People get pissed off easy and they hold it against you your whole life. And I'm thinking, whatever, I'm not fucking tiptoeing around to this planet. I'm sorry, but, you know, I didn't get here by tiptoeing around. Right. So, of course, I stepped on the wrong people a few times. And they make it a point to try to disrupt your career, and I still feel the, you know, reverberations of that. And yet, I don't think I'd do it any different if I went back, because you really have to be yourself, whatever that is. You
right.
know, you bring that's all you have to bring. In fact, so I brought that, and I got trouble with a few people for that. But no, I am what I am, and in the end, it works out. I might have missed a few opportunities with that, but I think I probably got a lot more opportunities because of being who I am. So
interesting. Well, that makes sense, since that you want to be yourself. I mean, you can't be somebody else.
Yeah.
Can I ask you what would have been the greatest lesson you've learned during this journey through music?
Yeah. You know, music is just is another way to know something about yourself. And it's not just true for you as a musician, but it's true for all the people listening to your music.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a certain responsibility you have, you know, to bring your best. And I learned that in the music, that I should bring my best lyrics, my best music, my best performance, 100% if I can. Because that also shows my gratefulness, you know, to existence gave me this. So it's not something I take for granted. So I learned something about that, you know, bringing your best and sharing that. And that will inspire people.
How do you know it's the best? How do you know when it is best?
Well, you know when you're bringing your best. You're not just cruising.
Right.
You know, you're trying to play as good as you can. You're trying to write as well as you can. You're moving yourself forward, you know, in spite of yourself. You're overcoming your limits. That's when you're bringing your best, you know. And it doesn't have to be the best in the world, in the eyes of the world, you know. It's just your best, you know. And it may fall short that day, but it's the best you got. And I always try to do that, you know. Without comparing, you know, there's guys that it's funny what gets successful. There's guys that play way better than me, tons of them. But the people come to my shows because of the unique person and musician I am. So that's a lesson, too. You know, we all got something. It's not only the super technical or the super intuitive. We all got something to offer.
And if I was to ask you, what is the best thing that you do in terms of the thing that you most enjoy and you think, this is amazing?
Well, I've managed somehow by sharing, you know, my own stories to lift people's spirit a little bit here and there. And they tell me that. They write me and they tell me how you changed my life, your music saved my life, or whatever. That's a great contribution for me. I'm happy with my life as a result of having done that. That's great.
So it's more positive messages, basically.
Totally, yeah, totally. You know, I'm so glad that that has that effect on people and that I was in a position to deliver that.
Do you remember the first time it happened?
Well, yeah, I sort of do. I mean, in Canada, you know, I came and I went to Salt Spring Island, to where I'm now living, and there was a little cafe, and I asked if I could play there, and the woman didn't know me, and she said, yeah, but I'm not setting up the mics or anything. I said, okay, I'll go and play. So I sat in the courtyard where people were having lunch, and I started playing my Vina, and it was the first time I played it, and I said, you know what, I don't care about this microphones, about the money or anything, I'm just going to play. And I started playing, I got in so into it, I forgot about the people. I looked up 10 minutes later, and there was like 100 people standing around me, staring at me, like really intensely, and I thought, oh, okay, this might work.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's been working for many years now.
Yeah, it's been working for a while now. I think it'll keep working, as long as I'm working.
So the string quartet is one thing. Is that tour, or is it just this one-off concert?
Well, I'm playing now in Toronto and Ottawa at the National Arts, and there'll be other shows. We're just starting to line that up now. Out west will be a bunch.
Will there be a recording?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I'm going to make a recording, I think, in Australia end of October.
Wow.
Yeah.
So with the quartet?
Yeah. Yeah, probably with an Australian quartet.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing that.
Yeah, it should be real nice. I've got some of the arrangements now, and they sound lovely. Sound really good. Clayton Doley is writing the arrangements.
Okay.
My longtime keyboard friend from Australia. Yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for this time. I always enjoy talking to you. And thank you very much.